Butterfly camouflage. Have you ever thought about butterflies and how they hide themselves? A lot of them are so brightly colored that you might think that they would be easily spotted by predators and eaten up. And so is the case. A lot of butterflies are. For example, the monarch butterfly is very brightly colored, and the reason for that is because it will eat a certain plant that will transmit toxins into its body. So the birds will know by just looking at it to not eat it. But other ones, they don't eat on the same plants, and so they're fair game. But if you look at this butterfly right here, what does that look like? It looks like an owl. That's why they call it the owl butterfly. What does that look like? A leaf. And that's why they call it a dry leaf butterfly. And so you got to think about where did we come from? How did we get created? Or is this all an accident, like they say? If we were created, well, then you can look at these and think, wow, that is a marvelous design, and Lord knows exactly what he's doing here, because he would be scaring off predators by the look of this scary owl face. And in this other case here, they would blend in so they would never be seen. What an amazing design. But to someone who does not believe in God and wants to cast him aside, they have to think of a way to make those things happen there without any guidance at all. And so let's look at that and see which one makes the most sense. So here's some varieties here of camouflage. You can see this one has that speckled background, very hard to see against this background where it lives on. There's the owl butterfly again, folding its wings with the partner. There's a green one, mixing in perfectly. The dry leaf one is there, this one with its folded wings. This one brightly colored, but almost impossible to see. You can see it right there. So how would that come to be? So let's look at National Geographic's explanation. It says, usually it's assumed that for mimicry to evolve, a major change or mutation needs to occur in the organism's DNA that takes the animal into the ballpark area where it resembles the thing it's supposed to be looking like, he explained, the scientist. People have generally been skeptical about explanations where these traits evolve in tiny little bits across many generations, Speed added. Part two of that. If, as in the case of dead leaf butterflies, the ancestor species already has a degree of camouflage, then I don't think it's as hard to evolve, become leaf-like, by small steps, Speed said. When you already look like a bit like the background, but don't have the shape of a leaf, and then evolve a trait that's a bit more leaf-like, a predator tends to overlook you a bit more, he said. Then the other leaf-like traits could gradually accrue. What's the big if there? Are you spotting it? You see it there? When the ancestor species already has a degree of camouflage. Notice what they're doing whenever they will present an evolutionary example in the textbooks for our children is they will say, let's start with a butterfly or a moth that's already blending in. And which one is going to be the best one? That's where natural selection comes in and will weed out the ones that are not quite as good at blending in. But what if you weren't originally looking like this leaf? How would you get there in the first place with no, you know, with a blank slate, a blank piece of paper, and you say, draw this out for me, but don't do it intentionally, do it by accident. Do it by rolling the dice. Do it by blindfolding yourself and drawing this out on a piece of paper. Let me look at something here because they alluded to something that I don't want to pass by. Lest you think that I'm just kind of coming up with this idea offhand. I thought, well, let me look at the study that was actually published. Let me make that a little bit bigger so you can see it. Gradual and contingent evolutionary emergence of leaf mimicry in butterfly wing patterns from Evolutionary Biology. This is a peer-reviewed paper. This is the science that they will intimidate our kids into saying, this is what's out there, guys. Everybody believes it because all the scientists know that this is true. So look at this here. The highlighted part. It says, The process by which leaf patterns evolved remains unclear, right? So right there, they just said, okay, well, we're just studying something where we kind of know what's going on. What are they talking about then, right? They're looking at how they got more leaf-like, but they already start with the leaf pattern, and then they're going from there. And so notice what they're doing. The next highlighted section right here, Kallima, that's a dry leaf spider, butterfly, and 45 closely related species share the same ground plan, suggesting the patterns involved. Okay. So let me ask you this. Let me break this down. Let's say I came to Church of God Seventh-day Visalia, and I said, you know what? I want to see if people are related, because maybe they came from each other. And I said, I'm just going to look at one group, okay? So anyone who has the last name Marido, I'm going to test their DNA and see if they're related. What do you think the result might be? It might be that they are related, right? That they're close together. So what did they do there? Kallima and 45 closely related species sharing the same ground plan. Is that a surprise or is that circular reasoning right there? They started with the assumption and then they proved it. Well, of course. So this is the kind of stuff that we have. So what I want to emphasize to you, every time I have a sermon, every time I have an opportunity, is to remind people that there really is a God. That it's not just something I stand up here and wish was true. It's something that's really true. It's something that's actually true. It's something that's based upon not just science, but recorded history. One of these days I need to switch over into that and start talking about the foundation of the Bible. Maybe I'll do that next time. We'll see. Okay. But to complicate it even further is how would it know to evolve into a leaf-like pattern when it has to go through these four stages here? At which point did the DNA modify? And if you modified it here and it messed up the egg, then it never would come out here. It's so complicated. There's no way. Now notice this, and this makes it even more interesting too. You might think, well, that's just a neat pattern that emerged on this wing, right? But how are the colors on a butterfly's wing even formed? Do you know that? Well, this might blow you away, but this right here is a close-up of a butterfly's wing. This is even closer. That's a scale. They're all scales. And these little tiny, if you can see that, little ridges that are close together, they're closer together to make a color, and then they're further apart to make another color. In the nano scale, that's how they make the colors. The way that the scales are physically shaped, that's how they make the colors. It's not just painted on. It's not a pigment. It's the construction of the scale itself. And so what this is like is if you had a bunch of friends and you were trying to make a picture. And can you imagine the confusion? Some of you guys, if you've ever taken a yearbook photo and you're trying to do class of 2000 whatever, right? And you're holding up your piece of the sign and somebody's out of order and messes up the whole thing, right? That's kind of what it's like, except you've got all these different scales to work out. All of them. At the same time. How does that just happen? Well, the only way it happens is if a creator God not only cares about the sparrows or the butterflies, but he cares about you and me. That's the only way it works. Because this kind of stuff is just not possible. Not possible to just happen if you throw a bunch of scales up on the wall or roll a couple of dice. But what I want to do, and this is a little bit related to Father's Day, more so toward the end, but I really want to cover the question of evil, because this is probably the most difficult question that ever comes up to Christians, is what about all the bad stuff that's going on out there? And does your God care about that at all? I had a sickness, and I prayed, and God didn't heal me. And some terrible thing happened. There was a good person in my church that I knew. And some terrible thing happened to them. I read about a kid who died not too long ago of cancer, a horrible disease, in pain, in a hospital wing. Does your God care about that? What about that mother who left four kids behind? Why doesn't God heal us every time we ask, even for believers? And these are the tough questions that we have to ponder and think about. Because when you really get down to it, and sometimes I listen to family radio off and on, and they have a prayer request time. And it's not just, Lord, please bless my school so that I can finish my homework when on the deadline instead of when I was supposed to 2 weeks ago. It's not that kind of stuff. It's real heavy-duty stuff that they get on the radio and they say, there's this tough thing with my living situation. And you're like, man, what would I do with that? My sister has cancer and I don't know how to help her because she's got her kids, but I can't be there for her, so I need prayer and to figure this out. These kinds of heavy issues, right? Or I've got this heavy illness, even today, and I ask for your prayers. My wife is struggling because she had an operation and she's in a lot of pain. That's why she's not here. And several among us also have been struggling with illness as well. And, we prayed for her ahead of time. And I don't blame God because that was the answer that he gave. But what do you do with the question? And do you just say, well, God doesn't care? Because I don't believe that. So how do you make sense of it? That's what I want to go through today in this talk. I'm not the first one who's ever pondered this. In fact, this comes up over and over and over again. And it's actually in the Bible. Two different times, actually probably more than that I could have brought out. But Habakkuk is a book that is all about this question. This entire book is about that. So you can read that book for yourself, the whole thing, and read the prophecies that are in there. We'll read selections right now. We'll start in chapter 1, verses 2 through 4 of Habakkuk. And he says to the Lord, O Lord, how long shall I cry and you will not hear? Even cry out to you, violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see troubles? For plundering and violence are before me, there is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds. And so he's asking God in a way, Lord, what are you doing? You're not listening. Can you not see what's going on? And so in this case, the Lord answers him directly. To his first question, God replies, and he says more than this, but this is what he says here in verse 5. Look at the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days, which you would not believe, though it were told you. And so right there, we can notice, just by looking at the passage, that God has a plan. He does not always make us aware of that plan. And other times he does. Sometimes his plans are too much to believe. That we couldn't believe it if we had been told ahead of time. And so he's just going to say, I'm just going to take care of it, and you just need to relax and trust. But here he says, and he specifies, he goes on in the succeeding verses to say, what is going to happen about all this injustice that is happening in Jerusalem? And he goes and specifies what's going to happen based on that. But notice that he says, look and watch, be astounded, I will work a work in your days which you wouldn't believe. In other words, he already had this whole thing in motion before the prayer was even uttered. So God is in total control, and he knows what he's doing. And so Habakkuk says, okay, fine, that's good. But let's talk about the other part of the question, but I'm going to get to that in a second as well. Okay, so now let's look at this. All of creation suffers together as well. This is along the first question. Does God not hear this? And Paul also echoes this. And this is Romans 8:18-23. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time... Okay, notice that he's acknowledging the fact that we are now suffering. Are we on heaven right now? In heaven right now, in the kingdom of God, or are we on earth, a sin-cursed world? What should we expect to happen? Should we expect good, or should we expect bad? And so part of it is the expectation that gets us into trouble, because then we start thinking, well, I should have good things. Good things should happen to my family. But yet they don't. Or good things should happen to those families, or whatever. But this is not the place we live. We're on a planet that's in rebellion to God. So notice Paul says the same thing. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. Verse 21, the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption. Notice that it's not just we're having a bad time, but it's bondage. It's like you're in slavery to this thing here. Into the glorious liberty of the children of God. So we're all looking forward to this future. For we know that the whole creation groans. Now, if you've ever been in pain to the point where you're like, okay, that's what this conjures up. Right? The whole creation is that way. And we see so many things, even in the animal kingdom, that are difficult to understand. Why do bad things happen to good people? Each month, according to this website, 322 Christians are killed for their faith. 214 churches and Christian properties are destroyed. 772 forms of violence are committed against Christians, such as beatings, abductions, rapes, arrests, and forced marriages. And we're not talking about, you know, hey, don't come to my party because I don't like the way you talk about Christ and stuff. I mean, we're not talking about that kind of persecution. We're talking about, you know, we're going to come and get you and your family kind of persecution. Every month. And that's probably on the low side. According to the Pew Research Center, 75% of the world's population lives in areas with severe religious persecution. And many of these are Christians. 60 countries. So is God aware of these things? Not too long ago, in May, at the end of May, in Ramadan massacre, Egyptian Christians were killed for refusing to renounce their faith in Jesus. And this is an amazing passage here. Do bad things happen to good people? It says here there were about 29 people who died. They were on a bus. They were not on a bus to go to a sporting event. They were not on a bus just to go to the water park. They were not on the bus just to have a good time listening to music. They were on a bus that was going to take them to this church where they were going to pray. They were on a pilgrimage there. And so then they got stopped by these militants with machine guns. And then they asked each one of them as they came off the bus, will you renounce, are you a Christian, first off? And if they would have said no, well then it would have been a lot easier for them. But they all said yes, including 10 children. And then they said, secondly, will you convert to Islam? We'll let you go. And each one of them said no. And as soon as they said that, then they were killed. 29 people. Does God take an awareness of that? Does he know what's going on? And so, yes, that is the reality of our present day world. There are bad things that happen, even to good people. But on the other hand, you have a situation where the rich and famous, who are not at all following what God says that we need to do, they get away with anything. And pretty much they have lavish lifestyles. They can party it up and it's almost like there's nothing bad happening to them, right? They get to a place and then they can mock God and they can also get praise for it from the world. And how does that make sense? So Habakkuk continues in verse 13. You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness. Why do you look on those who deal treacherously and hold your tongue when the wicked devours a person more righteous than he? And in chapter 2, verse 1, I will stand my watch and set myself on the rampart and watch to see what he will say to me and what I will answer when I am corrected. So Habakkuk is looking for an answer. He says, please correct me, God, because this is what I'm seeing happening right now. Jeremiah also, in a separate verse, says the same type of thing. Jeremiah 12, 1 through 2, righteous are you, Lord, when I plead with you, yet let me talk with you about your judgments. Let's have a little talk, Lord. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are those happy who deal so treacherously? You have planted them. Yes, they've taken root. They grow, yes, and bear fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind. Why are the wicked doing well? And so the answer comes. The Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain on tablets that he may run who reads it. Verse 3. Now, this is such a powerful verse right here. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it will speak and it will not lie. Though it tarries, wait for it, because it will surely come and will not tarry. Behold the proud, his soul is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Habakkuk 2:14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And so what does that tell us? The vision is yet for an appointed time. And so if you go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, when they were cast out and they lost their life, eternal life, okay? Jesus gave them a promise at that point and said, he will strike your heel and I will strike his head. I reversed that. That meant that he would find a way to destroy sin and restore everything that was lost. And so we've been waiting this entire time for that to happen, have we not? We've been waiting through the antediluvian period where these people lived tremendously long ages, and then there was the flood. Then we, you know, had the time of the judges. Then we had the time of the law. Then we had the time when Jesus came back and he was on the cross and people said, oh, surely he's coming right now. This is going to be it. He's going to establish the kingdom. And he says, no, not now, not now. And the disciples even asked him after he was resurrected, is now the time when you're going to restore? And he says, it's not for you to know the times or the seasons that the Father has put in his own authority, but go and preach the word. And so here we are from that time, 2,000 years later. And is it hard if God was to say to you in the struggle that you're in, for the vision is yet for an appointed time, though it tarries, wait for it. What does that tell us about how our perspective must be when we look at worldwide events? Is it something to where we see an injustice and, hey, where's God? What the heck happened? Or should we say, wait, but there's something after that. What is that that we're waiting for? Notice in Daniel as well. This is after Habakkuk, quite a few years. So Daniel 11:27, this angel is prophesying about later time events. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil. They shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. There's a timetable, and God knows what it is. And so notice Habakkuk's response. A lot of times it's easy for us to say, well, I mean, I'm just tired of waiting. I'm just really tired of waiting, and I guess I'm just going to become an atheist and all this stuff. This is what some people do. But what does Habakkuk do? There's two things that we find him doing here. In Habakkuk 3:1 through 2, a prayer of Habakkuk, notice what he does next. He prays. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shigionoth. O Lord, you have heard your speech and was afraid. O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. So from this verse, we see that Habakkuk was able to catch the long view and to see it. And once you see that long view, you can't go back to that short-term thinking. Revive your work in the midst of the years. In other words, the way I see that being written is, don't let your people give up. Keep people strong. It's going to be a while. But that judgment is certain. And you can see what he says here, in wrath, remember mercy. And so there he acknowledges the fact that it's not just Habakkuk who is upset at the sin that goes on a daily basis, not just then but now. God as well is going to do something about it, and he will be coming in wrath when he comes a second time. And so Habakkuk asks him, remember mercy. And so awareness of this, it brings the prayer of godly fear. There's patience. There's call for mercy as well. It puts us on a path to where we say, okay, well, you know, maybe it's going to be tomorrow, but maybe it's going to be many years after I'm out, right? I've got work to do. And so I have to be there to revive his work in the midst of the years. It's my job to carry this forward. It may be a while. And notice the second thing that comes from Habakkuk as well. Chapter 3, 17 through 19. Though the fig tree, when you say though, even though things may not go right, even though I see all of these injustices, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he will make my feet like deer's feet. And he will make me walk in the high hills. To the chief musician with stringed instruments. Notice he makes up a song about it. Right? So the praise comes out when you start to see that God is going to be there at the very end. And he's here now. So my friends, I do want to comfort you guys as well as I comfort myself. Sometimes it is hard to go through. Sometimes it isn't easy to look around and to see all the stuff that's going on, especially if you're the one experiencing it. Sometimes it's not easy when someone tells you, and you know they can't tell what they're talking about, and they say, just hold on, I'll pray for you. And you're like, you have no idea. But thank you. Okay. This is what we have as our hope. And it's no small thing. 1 Thessalonians 4:13 through 18. I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren. Don't let go of this fact concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. Do not forget what's coming. Otherwise, you sorrow in the face of evil as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For we say to you by the word of the Lord that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. Verse 17, then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. Thus shall we always be with the Lord. Therefore comfort one another with these words. Man, what a glorious hope. So that child dies of cancer. Is he going to be there, restored in the kingdom? Is that person with a feeble body or a feeble mind, are they going to be restored in the kingdom? Are my illnesses that I have to deal with all the time, are they going to be healed and restored in the kingdom with the new body that God is going to give us? Yes. Peter also echoes the same thing in 2 Peter 3:8 through 13. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. And so why does he say that? Well, yeah, God lives forever. Fine, okay. But this is what he ties it into. Notice, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Now, some of you might be saying, well, I still haven't gotten my answer. Why did these people die? Why did all these bad things happen? Why did it happen? It's right there. You see it? Verse 9. That's why all this evil stuff is allowed to continue. It's not an accident. It's not for no reason. It's not because God doesn't care. It's because he does. And the fact that he is allowing things to happen is only because his patience and his long-suffering is being mistaken for weakness and absence. That's the problem with our perspective out in the world especially. People are making the mistake of saying, well, he's not around. No, he's waiting for you. He's patient with you. He's patient with me. I don't know where I'd be if he hadn't waited for me. Who knows where I would be? But yet he did. Why? The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness. He's not waiting for no reason at all. He's not waiting for 1,000 years just because he wants to take a little trip and just let us all take care of ourselves for however long. There's a reason for it. Look, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish. He's going to wait for the last one to be saved. Isn't that glorious? That's the kind of patience that we need to have as well with other people when they need to have the gospel preached to them, or whether they need to be encouraged, or whether they're giving up or having a hard time. That's the kind of patience where we have to be long-suffering and patient with people, and patient with ourselves and patient with God. There's a reason why this whole thing is playing out. And so, you know, I would love for the Lord to come back today. There's a lot of things on my list that I would like to see fixed. But if I think about it, and someone were to ask me just a straight up question. Now, Joe, if I could come today, if God asked me, let's just play this out. God asked me, hey, Joe, I could come today. Everything's lined up and everything. But if I wait a week, then this other person will be saved. Should I come now, or do you want me to wait? I'm like, well, how about if we wait? That's one more person, right? If I have the mind of Christ, that's what I would be saying. Now, what if you said to me, now, Joe, I know I could come back within your lifetime and I could fix all this stuff, but if I wait another 150 years, then about 117,000 more people will be saved. What should be my response at that point? Well, Lord, I wish I could see it, but I'll see what I can see when I get the resurrection, right? That's what you've promised. This is his long suffering. And if we understand his mind, then it will change our hearts. And if we understand what he is doing, then that is the encouragement that we face. And so when that busload of Christians is martyred, was anything lost? Jesus said, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body and afterward have nothing else that they can do. But be afraid of the one who can not only kill the body, but kill the soul. And so we need to adopt his mind. So verse 13 here, nevertheless we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. It's not just going to be, okay, the same way as it is now, where all this stuff is allowed to just pass. He's going to put an end to it. It's going to be done. It's going to be one way. It's going to be the other. You guys go here. The other guys go here and come with me. That's going to be the way it is when he shows up, and he will. That's a certainty as a fact can be. And so I ask you to look forward to that with me as we go through this time of groaning. And the fathers, you know, typically fathers, you know, are ones to set the vision in a family. I ask you, you know, as this Father's Day is coming up here, that you make an effort, a much more renewed focus, to transmit this vision to your family and to ensure that your generations that follow after you will take this on to however many generations the Lord will wait for that last person to be saved. May God bless you.